This episode of Walsh Wednesday is brought to you by MHA of Dutchess County, Foam and Wash Car Wash, Juniors 2, the Council on Addiction Prevention and Education of Dutchess County Incorporated, Day Rock, Locks That Rock Hair Design, A Touch of Naples Pizza and Pasta, Dutchess Beer Distributors, Filming Kleiman Collins and Sape LLP, Attorneys at Law, and Walsh Valuation.
Let's stay curious, keep an open mind, and as always, I'm glad we get to spend some time. Welcome to Walsh Wednesday.
I do got to share just a couple of things with you. I have gone as a Halloween costume for a good amount of the films that you've worked on at this point. You talk about Austin Powers. My girlfriend and I, we did Austin Powers and Felicity. And
oh, that's awesome.
You talk about Pirates of the Caribbean. I was Captain Jack Sparrow. She was Elizabeth Swan. You know, we did stuff like that. It's kind of funny, like looking at your IMDb. I was like, oh, wait, I did that for Halloween. I did that for Halloween. I did that for Halloween. They say like the Halloween test is like the moment that something has really hit the zeitgeist.
Yes.
And, yep. You know, the fact that you've been a part of so many of my Halloween costumes, let alone so many other people's Halloween costumes. I just thought that was like a little like, I don't know, just a little feather in the hat. Hey there, and welcome back to Walsh Wednesday. As always, I'm Connor Walsh, coming to you from the MHA studios here in Poughkeepsie, and we got a great crossover episode for you guys today. Yes, crossover. So this coming Monday, May 4th, we are going to be starting Your Best Use Starlight Spotlights through Mental Health America, where we're talking with people in the entertainment industry about their success and their psyche. It's going to be a lot of fun, and we're going to be having today's guest on that. But before he is on that show, we get him on Walsh Wednesday first. So you can listen to this episode, and then we got a completely new discussion of new topics next Monday. Check that out for more. We're going to have a lot of fun guests lined up for that, along with plenty of fun guests here on Walsh Wednesday. That's enough for future planning. We might as well get into this episode. He has over 80 credits on IMDb, working in special effects and makeup. He's been in the industry, and he's been working on some of your favorite films and franchises. Really excited to get into this today. So with us, we have one of the most prolific makeup artists of our generation, Hollywood makeup FX artist, Mark Viniello. Mark, how are you?
I'm great, Connor. How are you?
Doing good. So just to let the audience know, we have a little bit of a connection. We've actually known each other for a few years. My dad played golf with your dad and uncle, and that's how we met years ago before I had a beard.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
I know. And it's kind of crazy that we're getting to have this opportunity to speak now, and I get to hear more about your career. And I guess the first thing I just want to talk about is your generosity. When you met me as a 10-year-old kid, you sent me a couple of props from movies you were in. I was a big Pirates of the Caribbean fan at the time. You sent me a prop of Will Turner's coin and a prop of Davy Jones's key, along with photos from your career. How nice and generous that was to send to some random 10-year-old kid. Sure, our dads knew each other, but like beyond that, you didn't have to do that. So thank you.
You're welcome. I mean, remember, I was that 10-year-old kid once too, that somebody took the time to send me something and it really meant a lot to me, and I've never forgotten that. So anytime I can pay it forward, I'm more than happy to do so.
Absolutely. So Mark, let's get into this. I could spend the entire time listing off your IMDb, but that'll take up the entire interview. So for those who are watching and listening to this, what are some movies and franchises that they would be familiar with your work in?
Well, the big one would be the Lord of the Rings trilogy. I went down to New Zealand and I helped out on those films. Jurassic Park 3, Austin Powers 2, The Spy Who Shagged Me, the first Jumanji with Robin Williams, The Santa Claus. More recently, Stranger Things season 1 contributed to the Demigorgon, the practical costume. The Mandalorian TV series. Pirates of the Caribbean, you mentioned that I worked on 2 and 3. Sometimes they all kind of blur together. I'm like, oh yeah, I did work on that. Godzilla, the 1998 Godzilla, I worked on that. Tremors 2, Aftershocks, that was one of my earlier films. I did a little thing while I was at Spectral Motion for Avengers Infinity War. We redid Paul Bettany's Vision Cowl. Chris Pratt's The Tomorrow War. The Curse of Bridge Hollow, which is a fun Halloween film on Netflix. And then most recently, Blumhouse's Imaginary. It's a film about a haunted teddy bear.
That's sick. And that's only a small portion of your IMDb. What an incredible career that you've had. That's really awesome.
I feel very blessed and lucky that I've been allowed to work on such great stuff and that people really liked it. Starship Troopers, that's another big one.
Oh, another good one.
Yeah. Yep. People love Starship Troopers, yeah.
Yeah, I remember when you sent me all that stuff in the box, besides the Pirates of the Caribbean stuff, I wish I had the stuff with me. I should have brought it, but I think
you still
was.
Have it?
Oh, of course. Did you think I would get rid of it?
I don't know.
No.
Things get lost. I don't know. People move. They grow. I don't know.
No, it's still in the house. That's for sure. So no. But I remember you sent me pictures of you in the pterodactyl getup for Jurassic Park 3.
Jurassic Park 3. That was a big one.
I remember you sent that, and you sent stuff for, you said you worked on Alien Resurrection, right? I'm pretty sure it was from one of the Alien films too. So I remember, like, obviously, you know, being a 10-year-old boy, I was very familiar with those franchises. Like, this is so cool.
Yeah, it was, it is fun. And I still love what I do. I still get a charge out of what I do. I still sometimes have to pinch myself that I still do what I do and the people I work with and the experience I've had. So I feel very, very fortunate.
Yeah. No, before we kind of get into the nuts and bolts of like your early career and how you got into all this, I just got to say, it's not every day that you have like two connections to the Jurassic Park franchise in the Hudson Valley. Joe Mazzello, who lives in Hyde Park, was the kid from the first one.
The first one, yeah.
And here you are, you know, you got to be in the later installments. So,
yeah, wow. Hudson Valley's big on dinosaurs.
I was going to say, if I had a nickel for every time somebody from the Hudson Valley was in the franchise, I'd have two nickels. But
right, weird, that sense.
it's still weird that it happened twice, right? But so on another program that I host, and for anybody who's familiar with my work, you might have seen this, Walsh Wednesday, we've had Kevin McCurdy's Haunted Mansion on a couple of times. And the very first time that I interviewed Kevin and Holly, they gave you a shout out. And we were like, oh, I know Marty. And we were going back and forth. So that was like one of your earliest experiences working in makeup and effects, wasn't it? Can we talk about that?
I would love to. So at the time I was living actually in Danbury, Connecticut, and we were going to move to the Hudson Valley, and I was 14 or 15. And my aunt, who lived in the Hudson Valley, she said, you know, there's this Kevin McCurdy and he has a haunted mansion and you know, they do stuff that you do with monsters and masks. And would you like to meet him? And I said, that sounds great. I would love to meet him. And I remember my aunt picking me up from school and driving to Kevin's house, and he was in his garage, and Kevin was just very gracious and very kind and patient with this nerdy 15-year-old kid that was geeking out and all his stuff. And then they took me over to where the mansion was at the time. It was actually in Bowdoin Park.
Yep.
And I remember him walking me through, and I was just it really checked all the boxes for me. Even to this day, I have a hard time being an attendee somewhere, like at a concert or something. I want to go backstage. I want to see how it works. I want to see the people working. And that really got that moment when he's showing me around the mansion and showing me this is the control room and this lights this up and this does this. And I just fell in love with it at that moment. And the first time I really think I did makeup on someone I'd never met before, usually like gluing shit to my face or doing things on friends, was for the Haunted Mansion. And the makeup artist was a guy named Don Deesh, who's now a professional magician who goes by the name Vlad. He does gothic magic. He, you know, looked at my stuff and we talked. He's like, oh, you know what you're doing. But then I remember that people started coming in. He was doing makeup. I think there might have been other people doing makeup. And I was just kind of like, I didn't know what to do. He physically grabbed me, sat me down, put a grease paint stick in my hand, sat a girl in front of me and said, go. And that's kind of what it took to just open the floodgates. And I've really been doing makeup ever since.
Wow. That's awesome to have somebody like that who can just be like, plop, here you go.
Oh,
do it.
They were wonderful. It was what was great about Kevin and Don, and really everyone at the mansion. It really was kind of like the Island of Misfit Toys, where, you know, you had theater kids there, you had the actors there, you know, and you know, me, when I was in Danbury, I was really the only kid that liked monsters and movies and stuff like that. No one was really into it, but there I could name somebody like Tom Savini, and like, oh, and Don showed me this book by Tom Savini called Grand Illusions. I think it's called republished as Bizarro now, but it was awesome to see that okay, I'm not alone. There's other people that know about this stuff and, you know, are into it like I am. That was, and these guys were older, so I looked up to them, you know? So it was really, really, and they were just so patient, so nice with me too. I'll never forget that.
They're still so patient and so nice. I've worked with them a lot, actually, over this last year. We did a lot of different projects together, and it's so phenomenal. And funny how you said Island of Misfit Toys, because for their, for their holiday celebration, they actually constructed the Island of Misfit Toys.
They really?
Yeah. Yeah. So they had Kevin, all of them.
Kevin, when I met him, I'm like, I was blown away at how talented he was. And then I went to Hollywood and working there for a while. You know, we got to see like professionals and big budget stuff. And, you know, I went back not too long ago, a few years ago, and I saw the escape room, Escape Time Adventures they're doing. And I got to tell you, the quality of work that comes out of there that they produce could be on any big budget film in Hollywood. The way Kevin is able to craft stories and, you know, he makes these whole scripts and backstories about the mansion. He does it in a way where I am blown away still to this day. After having worked in Hollywood now for over 30 years, I can still go back and just be floored by Kevin's talent and his creativity.
Yeah, honestly, it really is insane. Actually, on a Walsh Wednesday episode, I brought some friends over and the whole idea was to try to escape one of the escape rooms. And we filmed it and it was such a fun time. But you're right, the storytelling aspect of it. And then, you know, when I went to the Haunted Mansion, of course, you know, I've done a lot of different haunted houses, haunted mansions. I've acted in a few. But the one thing that I have to say about, you know, Kevin McCurdy's is the storytelling. It's like, it's not just you show up and you get scared. There's a narrative. Mm-hmm. There's a whole thing. And like some places that you go to with these haunted mansions, you kind of, it's stop, start. You have to wait for the next thing. No, once you're in, you're in it. There's no breaks. You're just straight in it for the ride. And that's something I really admire about that. There's a lot to admire about that. But how awesome for that to be one of your first experiences. I can see how that really stayed with you. Just like the few 100%. Times that we have interacted, I can see that willingness and that joy and that creativity in you. And that's always been there.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's, you know, if you don't like what you're doing, why are you doing it? You know, I mean, this was a crazy dream I had as a kid. I don't even know if I could do it. And it, you know, Hollywood might as well have been another galaxy. It seemed so far removed from where I was. It really, I still, like I said, to this day, I still pinch myself that I'm here and I'm doing the stuff and I get to meet the people I meet and work on the stuff I work on. So, but, and I can still remember viscerally working at the Haunted Mansion. I did work there too. And I'd dress myself up in zombie makeups and stuff and scare people. And I had a great time doing that. So again, I owe Kevin a lot. Kevin's done a lot for me. Again, taking time, being patient with this like weird kid that he, you know, just took the time to show me how to make a plaster mold. You know, you read about it, but really physically see it and then do it. That makes all the difference in the world.
Naturally. No, that is so, so cool. So let's kind of back it up a little bit further then. In my research, getting ready for this interview, I heard that one of the big inspirations that you had getting into everything was Lon Chaney Sr., a.k.a. the man of a thousand man of a thousand faces. He's known especially. I know him for the original, like Phantom of the Opera movie. That's where I know him from. Yeah, talk about that love for like the early monster movies and the early makeup that got you like so hooked on this at an early age.
So when going way back now, my mother passed away a week after I was born. So my father took us to live with my grandmother in Connecticut, in Danbury, Connecticut, and he worked to support us both, and she essentially raised me. She is first generation. She was born in Italy. She was off the boat. She came here in 1919. She lived through the Depression, the World War, and she loved the movies. And there was a book in my house, and I don't know where it came from. It was a scholastic book called Movie Monsters, and the author's name was Alan Ormsby. I don't know where it came from. I don't know who got it. I don't know, but it's one of my earliest memories is having this book. And each chapter of the book had a different monster. Like one page was Frankenstein, one page was Dracula, King Kong. But the first page was the man of a thousand faces. And there was an image of a makeup box and these all these faces coming out of it. And my grandmother had gone to the movies and saw the first run of Phantom of the Opera and The Hunchback of Notre Dame and all the Man Who Laughs and all these other films that he did. And she was a huge fan of his work. And, you know, I kept asking her, like, how did he do this? And she would explain it to me. I still didn't quite understand how someone could make their face look all this way. But, you know, she explained that, you know, he was this masterful actor and a phenomenal makeup artist that would literally change his whole body in some cases from film to film to be this character. You know, I learned in the book that he, his parents were both deaf and couldn't speak. He could hear and talk, but his parents couldn't. So as a kid, to communicate, he would learn sign language. And a lot of film historians believe why he was such an effective silent movie actor is that he could convey emotion naturally. It was just because he did it his whole life, you know, communicating with his parents. So he could convey these things to the audience in a way that could reach them, but a lot of other actors couldn't. And his ability to just transform from role to role, it really struck a nerve with audiences, and it did with this, you know, five-year-old kid in Danbury, Connecticut a long time ago.
Wow. That's insane. And it's also funny you mentioned The Man Who Laughs. I forgot that he was a part of that as well. Naturally, that became the inspiration for Batman's The Joker, you know?
I might have been mistaken. So if it was The Man Who Laughs, that was Conrad Veidt. And that was, so it might have been He Who Slapped. I keep thinking of Laugh Con Laugh. Again, it's been a long day. So you are correct. So you just clicked all in. The Man Who Laughs was an actor named Conrad Veidt. He also was in a movie called The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. But The Man Who Laughs was a makeup by Jack Pearson. You are correct. Bob Keane and I think Bill Finger were the ones that took that for The Joker. Lon Chaney did The Penalty where he didn't have legs. He did a clown one that for some reason I said The Man Who Laughs. It might have been He Who Was Slapped. I don't remember. He did 150 films and it was a pretty impressive resume. resume that he had for the silent era.
Yeah, no, that is really impressive. Phenomenal. I was lucky enough to speak with one Joker voice actor, JP Karliak. He did work for the Suicide Squad Kills the Justice League. And that was cool to kind of get into the background of the Joker with him from that aspect. So, yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
Oh, yeah, no. Cool guy. Cool guy. He worked on that. He worked on X-Men 97. He did a number of different things. But I digress. Well, this is about you, of course. But no, that's awesome that you had this experience. And it was a familial experience, too. You were able to enjoy this with your family. So that makes it even more close to heart. So you have moments like that. You have moments that, you know, here you are with Kevin McCurdy's. Another thing that I realized in my research of you getting things going is you were also greatly inspired by the first Jurassic Park before you even went out to California. If I'm not mistaken, you saw it at the Poughkeepsie Galleria and you vowed that is like, I'm going to be a part of that one day.
Yeah. June 11th, 1993. I'm at the Poughkeepsie Galleria. I had plans to leave a month later and drive across country. I'm 22 years old to seek my fame and fortune in California. And that was the last film I saw in New York at the Poughkeepsie Gallery. I had family and friends there. It was everything I wanted it to be. I had heard about this film that was, you know, a year in advance. You've got ILM, you've got Stan Winston, you've got Steven Spielberg. I mean, what could go wrong? It was everything I wanted it to be in a film. And, you know, and as a kid growing up seeing the King Kong movies and the Ray Harryhausen films and the dinosaurs, I was all in. And I, you know, again, it was everything I wanted to be. And yeah, at the end of the film, I stood up and I told everyone, I'm going to work on the sequel one day. Mind you, I'm 22 years old. I've never worked on a film ever other than a student film at that time. I probably had a better chance being abducted by space aliens than working on any Hollywood film, let alone the unannounced sequel of the biggest film that year. And yet 6 years later, I'm working for Stan Winston. And I forget, we were finishing up like Austin Powers 2 or Galaxy Quest or one of those films, which are wonderful. It was a great experience working there. And the bay doors open and a forklift comes in with this giant mold. And I'm like, what's going on? And my friend's like, you didn't hear? I'm like, what? JP3 got greenlit. We got a year to build everything. I'm like, no way. I'm like, really? So I was over the moon that happened. And I was, again, very fortunate that Stan allowed me to be in this Pteranodon suit. And we had to prove that it was going to work. So the main artist, Chris Swift, and I mocked something up and I'm, you know, walking around the parking lot. We did this whole test and we're all nervous. And, you know, it was just a very loose mock-up with, you know, pipes and PVC and, you know, a fiberglass head molded out of a head that wasn't used for the second film. And I'm there and I'm like, I've been, you know, practicing and I'm all ready. And I, you know, Stan comes in and I take a couple of steps and he's like, it'll work. All right, let's make it. And he just left. Like he knew immediately, didn't ask any questions. He saw it. He's like, yep. And so we started making the Pteranodon. Wow. And Stan hired a personal trainer that would come in twice a week for myself and John Rosengrant, who was my supervisor, but he was also in the Velociraptor suits, to make sure that we were fit enough to wear these costumes and actually perform in them. Because Stan was always very much about the characters. These are just things. They are characters. And if you're going to be something, you better behave like this animal would. So, and these are very heavy, uncomfortable costumes. So John and I trained for months with this personal trainer in a gym at the studio that Arnold Schwarzenegger designed for Stan. So it was one of the most complete small gyms I ever worked out in. And it's a good thing too, because that was one of the hardest, the hardest costume I've ever worn.
Wow. Who would have thought that you'd have to worry about pumping iron and getting into shape to do something like, to be working in makeup and special effects in Hollywood?
I mean, it's, you know, it's good to just, because, you know, you're in this machine and you make sure it's running good, because if you are healthy, I mean, just not to go on a tangent here, but you think better, you think clearer, you're more creative, you're all the pistons are firing. But if I didn't train, that thing would have folded me in half. I wouldn't have been able to stand up. And also, you've got to remember, like, I've got this huge mechanical device. I mean, it's 125 pounds, 150 pounds. I'm on these stilts. I'm completely enclosed in this rubber suit. And I've got to perform multiple times, because it's like, okay, back to one, take two. Oh, back to one, take three. Okay, let's try it like this. Take four, take five. Like, it's pretty grueling. It can be very grueling, actually.
Yeah, I've worked on I haven't worked on any movie sets, but I've worked on TV sets. And just the amount of takes and over again in the long days and the preparation before you even have the camera rolling, those are long days. And the sets that I was working on were really basic. Like, when I say basic, it's like nobody was wearing big contraptions or a lot of makeup. They pretty much look like you and I right now with minimal makeup and, you know, just lighting and whatnot. So just adding that extra effect where you had all that stuff on you, that's huge. So with that being said, you know, I'm curious now, with all the different contraptions and mock-ups that you've had to wear besides put on for other people, but stuff that you've had to wear, what's one of your favorite?
The Trinidad is special to me for that reason, because of the declaration I made when I was 22. Yeah. I have a soft spot in my heart for the Chupacabra in the low-budget sci-fi movie Chupacabra Dark Seas.
Okay.
And Giancarlo Esposito was in it. He played Dr. Pena. My friend and colleague, Ken Niederbommer, did that whole build, and then we went down to the Turks and Caicos and shot it. That was a fun show. That one's special to me. Another one was one of the baby Godzillas in the 1998 Godzilla movie with Matthew Broderick. That was working for Patrick Tatopoulos, and that was a great honor. I mean, he's a huge Godzilla fan. And also, you know, playing the alien, or one of the aliens. I mean, Tom Woodruff was the main alien in Alien Resurrection. I was one of the multiples that was there. You saw the film, right? Alien Resurrection?
Oh, yeah, of course.
There's a scene where there's three aliens in a jail cell or a containment unit. And in some scenes, I'm like one of the ones turning around. Then another scene, I'm the one backing up. So they would shoot different angles and I'd play different aliens. And I remember what happens in the scene is, I'm not ruining it for anybody. The two aliens attack one alien and it bleeds the acid blood and it burns through the floor. And then that's how they escape. And so we shot the attack scene and then we're in the set and it's an enclosed set. We're in this like closet with, you know, glass, you know, windows, and there's a hole in the floor and special effects is rigging it. And Tom and I are in the suits and we're sitting there in apple boxes and I can only look out of the neck, like the head is out to here. And there's these little holes with mesh on them, so I can kind of see. And I'm, you know, looking at Tom, Tom's chilling. I'm looking at the hole and I see a little flame just kind of pop up and I'm like, huh. And then it lights around the ring and I'm like, this isn't good. Like, cause there's no way out. We are locked in this room and we're in these goofy rubber suits. So I look over at Tom, and he's just chilling. And I'm like, all right, well, if Tom's not worried, why should I worry? And the flames are starting to get bigger. And I'm like, I keep looking at Tom. Then the door opens, they come in with fire extinguishers. They get us out, they get us out of the suits. And I'm like, you're like, you're okay. I'm like, I'm fine. So I'm like, yeah. I'm like, okay, Tom, I'm like, thank you so much for like just chilling out and not freaking out, because I would have freaked out. He's like, because Mark, I was napping. I had no idea what was going on. So I was like, oh, okay. Well,
that's terrible.
Maybe I would have freaked out. Maybe I should have freaked out. Yeah. So
he
just kind of closed his eyes and was just chilling while they were setting up and, you know, caught a little nap. And I thought he was just being totally calm. There's nothing to worry about. We could have burned to death.
Holy crap.
I'm on fire. And Tom's like, I guess Tom's not freaking out yet. I guess I'm okay.
Oh my God. Yeah, no, there's a difference between zen and totally just out cold, I guess.
Complete unawareness, yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Thank God that it turned out the way that it did. You guys were unharmed. That's good.
Oh yeah. I mean, film sets, generally speaking, are pretty safe. I mean, accidents do happen, unfortunately. But usually there's a lot of people around and there's, you know, everyone really, you know, no one should be hurt or injured on a set. I mean, again, sadly, unfortunately, accidents do happen, but there's usually a lot of people there that can run to the aid of somebody if something goes sideways.
Yeah, no, naturally, I think that's, you have to be. There's a lot of people on set. There's a lot of liability.
Oh, yeah.
There's a lot of assurance. If one thing falls out of place, that screws up hundreds of jobs right there. And that is so key. Like, not even just like, hey, we have a timetable to make this happen. You also have all the people that are involved in all the different ways. Hence why you have the credits at the end of the shows and all the movies, because it takes a village, literally a village, to make things happen. And I, you know, one thing about being here with Mental Health America, one of the greatest things that I've seen is the collaboration amongst people and the way that everybody's been able to help each other out to help, you know, rise above certain things. And with that, working in makeup, special effects, things along those lines, you have to have a lot of collaboration. It's not just a solo mission on that. So could you elaborate on the collaboration that you've seen throughout your 30-year career?
I mean, there could be collaboration within the studio building the creature, because there's different departments to make a creature. You've got a sculpture department, a mold making department, a skin casting department, painting department, animatronics department, you know, fabrication. All of those have to work together, and everybody's job is usually dependent upon the department beforehand. So if somebody's late, it becomes a domino effect, you know, and then the painter, who's usually at the bottom of that hill, is the one that usually has the least amount of time to do their job. But that's the last step before it's on screen. So that, you know, working with just really talented, creative people is awesome. But on a set, you know, departments are very specific, and a lot of times it's different unions. So, you know, there's certain things you can and can't do. The challenge with what we do is that, you know, we sometimes do specialty costumes. We'll do like an Iron Man suit that a normal costume department couldn't do. You know, sometimes we'll do a specialty prop that has all these animatronic things that can be really weird. And, you know, so it is about respecting the other department and really coming to the department head and saying, look, we're here to help. Like, you're the boss. Like, this is what we were tasked with doing. Let's talk about, you know, your thoughts, because maybe there's some things that you think of and, you know, what we contribute. We're just here to help. We all have the same objective. We all have the same goal, and we're all working together to do it. I'm not here to steal anybody's thunder. I'm not here to, you know, say, look how awesome. No, I'm here to help. And I'm very, very conscious of being respectful to the department heads, because it is their department. And sometimes we're kind of thrown in, and, you know, we do our best to just reassure everybody, we're just here to help. That's all.
Amazing. And honestly, that's the best way of going about it. And I think that's a lesson that a lot of people can take really in whatever field that they're in, and not even just a field, but yeah, in their everyday life. And that's something that we're trying to inspire here with MHA. And again, I really appreciate you going into that when it comes to that aspect of the business. Before we get into some of the more you know, heartfelt stuff here that's connected with MHA, I want to nerd out a little bit. I'm a huge Lord of the Rings fan. I want to talk about that a little bit. That was the first credit that you mentioned when we were getting into your filmography. So what specifically did you get to do on The Lord of the Rings, which is still considered one of the greatest trilogies ever put to film?
It was special. It was unique. I had gone to New Zealand a couple of years earlier, and I filmed a Xena episode, and I got to fight Xena as a creature suit.
That's so neat.
That was fun too. That was a fun creature. The Destroyer, it was like season 3, episode 6, A Family Affair. And that was a lot of fun. And I had a couple of days off, so I took a little plane. I don't remember how I even charted this, but I went to Weta, which is, I was in Auckland, they were in Wellington. And I got to meet Richard Taylor. And of course I called ahead and he showed me around, and I was floored at the amazing work that they were doing down there. And I asked him some questions, like, are these stories really true that I heard about you guys? Like, I heard you guys sculpted in butter because you couldn't get clay. And he's like, not exactly, but he's like, essentially, yeah, because they couldn't get clay to New Zealand, and they had to sculpt these big heads. They took the waxy base that makes margarine, and they sculpted these heads out of this waxy base in a freezer, molded it, and then made the things they had to make. And I'm like, that Kiwi ingenuity is really second to none. And it really took it to another level on Lord of the Rings. So Lord of the Rings happened. They put out a call. They sent up a flare to everybody all over the planet that did this stuff and said, come to New Zealand. We need the help to make this stuff. And they reached out to me, and I was stoked. This was one of my favorite books as a kid. But I was working at Stan Winston's at the time, and we were just getting ready. We're just prepping for Jurassic 3. The molds had come in. Another film, AI, artificial intelligence, was at the studio, and I was the head of my department. And Stan always shut down for Christmas. He would shut the studio down for 2 weeks, give everybody time with their families. He was very adamant. And I said, hey, is it okay if I, you know, go work on this thing? I might be a little over the Christmas break. And he said, you can go, but I want you to give me your word as a man that you're going to come back here, because we've got some things starting that we need you for. And I gave him my word. It's a good thing I did, because I probably would have stayed down there. It was such an amazing time. It was one of those films that you hope you get to be a small part of. And I was a microscopic part of it. And I was, you know, when I was getting ready to go down, Richard and Tanya asked if I could bring this component that helps with some foam latex. It's called Setsit 104. It's a cure accelerator. This is way before 9/11. I just had it on my carry-on. It's just a liquid thing, and I brought it down with me. It's not toxic or flammable or anything. I mean, it's toxic. You don't want to drink it, but it wasn't going to do any damage. But I remember when I got off the plane, I handed it to them, and they were more excited about being able to get that because they couldn't get it in New Zealand. So I was in the foam latex room, which was my department at Stan's. And the head of that department was a guy named Xander Fortier. And there was like 6 or 7 people working there. And I went in and I just said, you know, hey, this is your room, dude. Just tell me what to do. And he just put me to work, and I just started helping everybody. And then after the first week, he said, so what do you think? And I said, there's a lot of work, guys. We'd start at 7 and we would be out the door at 6 p.m. with the last mold going in the oven. And we'd set the timer to have the molds cook overnight. And he said, would you do anything different? I said, well, there's some things I would do differently, because I've been doing this. I've done it a lot. I've done it a lot longer than he had at that time. And he said, would you mind? And I said, if you would allow me to, I would be honored to just kind of put in my 2 cents. So he let me kind of move some things around. And we would start it then at, you know, 6 or 7 in the morning, but then we would be out by like 2 or 3. And then those last couple of hours, we'd go to other departments and help them with some of the work that they did, because the scale and the scope of these films, what Weta did, I mean, I have a hard enough time just keeping track of the makeup effects and the prosthetics, but they did the costumes, the armor, the props, the miniatures. Like, it was how Richard Taylor was able to keep track of everything and keep the level of quality. I mean, that's a leader. And, you know, sometimes we'd be working Saturday. Richard would come in on a Saturday and he would clean out the fridge. You know, he even, you know, for the artists, he paid for models to come in on Wednesday and have like a sculpting from life class.
Oh, wow.
And he didn't charge. He said, anybody wants to do this, please come do this, draw from life. And the work, he said, the work quality, you know, any artistic endeavor is going to tell you, drawing from life, sculpting from life, that's the best that you can do. And so he did it, and the artist took advantage of it.
Wow.
Again, it was one of those moments that it really was so very special. And again, I just feel so lucky and honored to be a part of it. It was also during Y2K. Remember, the world was supposed to end at the year 2000. And it was going to end in New Zealand first, because that was the first industrial country to get lenin. And I'm like, what, I'm 28, 29 at the time. And I'm like, not married. I'm like, let's go. You know, if that's going to be ground zero, that's where I want to be. So I went down there. And of course, the world didn't end. And it wound up being not only a wonderful experience, and I have some dear friends that I'm still friends with now, thanks to social media, I can contact people, but it's still one of the most beloved trilogies. And I'm honored to just even have my name on it. I was there for such a brief time. I even felt embarrassed even getting my name on it, because people were there for years working on these films.
Mm, I understand that. But you know what? You were able to take those moments with you. You were able to make an impact during the short time you were there. And then you were able to take that with you for the other films that you worked on ever since that point.
Oh, yeah.
And it sounds like with Richard Taylor, you got to experience some phenomenal leadership. When you have phenomenal leadership running such a tight ship, but such a beautiful ship that people are proud to be on and proud to metaphorically sail on, you know, things are going to run smoothly. And besides, Lord of the Rings, like before the movies even came out, one of the most beloved book series ever came out there. You can pretty much base all of fantasy from the 20th and 21st century off of what Tolkien did there.
Tolkien did 100%. And when I heard Peter Jackson at the time, I'm like, shouldn't this be like Ridley Scott? How wrong I was. Like, I'm sure Ridley would have done great. Peter Jackson, he took that. He made it what it was. It was him that would just fought the studio, said, I am not going down in history as the guy that messed up Lord of the Rings. Like, we're doing this. Because they're like, you know, faster, faster, quick, the budget. He's like, nope, we're doing it right. And he would, I didn't get to go to set because we're just racing to get stuff done, but he would read from the book, supposedly the passages that they were going to shoot, just to make sure everybody was on the same page, you know, metaphorically and really, like what they were shooting at that time, to stay as close to the source material as possible. They were very passionate about it. And it shows.
Yeah, that just goes to show you, when, again, the right leadership, the right people at the helm, you know, people who are passionate about what they're doing, it makes a difference.
And pause. We're going to take a quick break from our interviews to hear from our sponsors. First up, we got our friend Andrew O'Grady from MHA of Dutchess County.
When we talk about mental health, we often focus on the symptoms, anxiety, depression, isolation. But what we don't talk about nearly enough is the root cause. And more often than not, that root cause is trauma. This is Andrew O'Grady, CEO at Mental Health America of Dutchess County. Trauma doesn't always look dramatic. Sometimes it's quiet. Sometimes it's an experience you've carried alone for years. Sometimes you've never spoken about it because it feels shameful or because you were told to just move on. But here's the truth. Holding a painful secret doesn't protect you. It weighs on you. It shapes how you think, how you feel, and how you move through the world. It can impact relationships and jobs, the way you attach to people and interpersonal friendships and work relationships, and you don't have to keep carrying that weight by yourself. Healing is possible when you finally feel safe enough to talk about it. Contact a therapist today. If you need help with that process, contact your primary care physician or call MHA of Dutchess County. We're happy to help you find someone. It's time to take care of yourself. You just may have the best year of your life.
For 60 years, we here at Foam and Wash Car Wash pride ourselves on giving back to the community, because we're your neighbors. It's our community too. In celebration of Foam and Wash's 60th anniversary, we want to say thank you. By visiting the link on screen and in the description, you'll receive one free hot wax and shine car wash. No hassles, no gimmicks, just a token of our appreciation. Foam and Wash Car Wash, home of the unlimited wash membership. Thank you for being part of Foam and Wash Car Wash's story for the last 60 years.
This episode is also sponsored by Juniors 2. Come on out to Juniors 2 in Poughkeepsie, New York for Thursday Night Trivia, hosted by CMJW Entertainment. Play as a team as you work your way through four rounds of trivia categories in order to win gift certificates and other prizes. Juniors 2 Trivia Nights, every Thursday starting at 7 p.m. at 1126 Dutchess Turnpike, Poughkeepsie.
Next, we have a message from our friend Jeff Feldman from Feldman, Kleiman, Collins, and Sape LLP, attorneys at law.
Hi, I'm Jeff Feldman. In 1986, when Paul Kleiman and I started our practice, our goal was to create a law firm where you could meet with an attorney and feel confident that that attorney would be with you every step of the way. Today, the firm has been successfully trying cases at all levels of state and federal courts throughout the Hudson Valley and Capital District. We have been selected as one of the best personal injury and medical malpractice defense law firms by U.S. News and World Report every year since 2009. For all of those years, we were the only firm chosen in any litigation specialty between Albany and White Plains. Your case is important to us. Giving you the time and personal attention you deserve has always been the hallmark of success. Initial consultations are free of charge and always with an attorney.
In 1 year, I went from unemployed making videos in my family room to becoming a top 40 under 40 honoree, gaining hundreds of thousands of views. And I'm just getting started. It's time for the second annual Walsh Wednesday Fun Drive. It's Connor coming at you once again, and what better day to launch the second annual Fun Drive than to do it on National Connor's Day? Seriously, that's a thing, not some April Fool's prank. Guys, 2025 was such a transformative year here at Walsh Wednesday, and I'm so excited to see what 2026 has to offer. Over the span of the last 60 plus episodes, not only have we gotten to speak with local leaders and creators, but we worked with platinum-selling artists, Broadway veterans, Hollywood actors, banana ball players, and even Olympians. Because of the hard work from this past year, Walsh Wednesday is once again nominated for Best Podcast, part of Hudson Valley Magazine's Best of Hudson Valley. None of this would be possible without you, so thank you. You can help Walsh Wednesday continue to grow by donating to our GoFundMe and by voting for Walsh Wednesday for Best Podcast. Both links can be found in the description of this episode. And if you don't have the funds to donate at this time, that's fine. I totally get it. Just sharing alone goes such a long way. We got some really cool plans for 2026. As you've seen, we've recently launched our trivia spinoff, Walsh Whiteboards, which honestly has been a blast to film. Not just that, we're hoping to go on the road more often to show you incredible sights, stories, exhibits, and more that can't be captured in the studio. From the bottom of my heart, I greatly appreciate you for believing in what Walsh Wednesday is and what it will become. The second annual Walsh Wednesday Fun Drive and the Best of Hudson Valley voting will end on April 30th. That being said, Connor Walsh signing off for Walsh Wednesday on National Connors Day. And as always, I'm glad we get to spend some time. Thanks for listening, guys. It's time to get back to the show. And play.
Mark, we could be here all day. I could listen to your stories constantly. I'll nerd out one more. I'll ask you one
go
more story about something, and then we'll kind of get into a lot more of the nuance, if you don't mind. But something that is more recent, something that is very much in the headlines right now, Stranger Things just came to an end, but you got to be on the ground floor of it. You were a part of it in season one, before Stranger Things even had a name. You helped design the Demogorgons into be what they are today, which is insane. Could you tell us about that time with Stranger Things?
Sure. So I'm at Spectral Motion, which is run by Mike and Mary Elizalde, and we got a call for this Netflix TV series, which was called the Untitled Duffer Brothers Project. And I had done some TV before. I did CSI New York. I did Heroes. I did 5 years on True Blood. You know, so I knew, and I'm like, I was the most likely candidate at the studio at that time to like head up a TV show. I'm like, well, let's do this. And I remember reading the scripts, and I got, you know, got chills a couple of times. I'm like, these are really well done. Like, this is like, and meeting the Duffers, they are, you know, children of the 90s, but they were fans of the 80s. It's like, you know, people watching Happy Days and being a fan of the 50s, even though you were never there. Like, they loved the 80s, and it really came through. So again, you work on something. Aaron Sims actually designed the Demogorgon, and it came to Spectral. We had to turn his design into a creature suit, which was not easy to do because the proportions were all wrong. So fortunately, we had an excellent creature suit performer named Mark Steger. Claire Fluin, our costume designer, really helped with that. Mark's a Trachian, did an amazing mechanism for this. And, you know, it was a challenge because TV, it's never enough time, never enough money. But, you know, you don't know what you're working on. And I got to fly out to Atlanta and work on the set. There's a scene in the forest where he's eating a deer. So I was there for that, you know, helping work on the Demogorgon. And then, you know, you come back and there wasn't a lot of times. It was just sending something. And then, you know, he wasn't in it like the full season. He was just in at certain points. So you do it and then you kind of forget about it. And then I guess a year or so later, I'm back east. I'm visiting my cousin Katie, who at the time was working for Hasbro, and she was giving me a tour of Hasbro. And I'm like, this is freaking cool. You have 3D printers and stuff. And all everyone was talking about was Stranger Things. And I'm like, wait, the Duffer Brothers thing? I think that's what they were calling it. What? It was the most lauded project. I mean, more than Lord of the Rings. Like, it was in the immediate zeitgeist of everywhere. You know, you hear about a movie comes out, hey, it's cool, blah, blah, but this was all everyone was talking about it, because I guess everyone sat and binge watched it. I think they all dropped at the same time.
Netflix does just, that, yeah.
Yeah, they just went bananas with it, and I was like, what? And it reminded me, it reminded me when I first met an actor who was in Star Wars. The actor, I don't remember his name, but he was the original Uncle Owen for Luke, who's telling Luke, you can't do this. You know, you're a farmer. You got to stay here. And I went up to him and I just said, man, what is it like being a part of something that changed pop culture and just, I mean, history? Like, you guys made history. Did you know you were making something special? He's like, what are you kidding me? George didn't know. My agent called me. So we got this thing. I shot it for 3 days and that was the end of it. Like, on to the next thing. Like, yeah. And it was this kind of the same thing with Stranger Things. I had no idea. I mean, I knew it was going to be good. I mean, the script was good, but I had no idea it was going to be such a phenomenon that it became. And that, again, talk about leadership. That's the Duffer Brothers.
Mm-hmm. No, it's incredible what they were able to come up with. It really was a cultural phenomenon. And, I know everybody's still kind of reeling over the fact. It's like, it can't be over. Conformity game, yada, yada. But no, it's done. They're going to make spinoffs. They're going to have, you know, everybody's going to move on with their careers. But just be so grateful for the incredible television that we got. And you got to be a part of that phenomenon. So, you know, now kind of getting into some of the more nuance of everything, kind of a similar question that you asked the actor from Star Wars, you know, pretty much asking you relatively the same thing. You've had so many iconic franchises under your belt to be a part of, even just a microscopic part, to use your own term, even just to be a part of it in these degrees, what is it like to be a part of these phenomenons that have touched millions, if not billions of people?
It's hard to say, because when you're making something, you have no idea how it's going to be received. Like when I was on Godzilla, the 1998 Godzilla, that was on the same production team had just done Independence Day. So they were primed to do something that's going to be even bigger than Independence Day. And it wasn't. I mean, it's gotten a life and cult following afterwards. I mean, the same thing with Starship Troopers is that when you're making it, you thought, you know, when I went to go see it, I'm like, it's not quite RoboCop, which is one of my favorite films. And I thought, Paul Verhoeven, it's going to be like RoboCop. And at the time, I was like, But again, it's gotten this life and this rabid fan base as the years have gone on. So, you know, really, Lord of the Rings, that one you knew was going to be special. You knew that one was going to be different. I mean, I can tell you films I worked on that I'm like, oh, just get me out of here. I want to shoot myself right now, because it's, why didn't I have just a desk job, you know? And it winds up being a huge hit. And there's other films like, I'm having a great time, and it turns out being terrible. The one exception to that was Galaxy Quest. That was a fun script. That was a fun build. It was a fun shoot, and it was a great movie. Like, that rarely checks all those boxes, but Galaxy Quest was the one that comes to mind that was a lot of fun. You know, a lot of times you go, you know, one of the first films I worked on was Jumanji with Robin Williams. And this was a lesson for me. One of the tasks I had is Amalgamated Dynamics, the company I was working for, made this amazing little animatronic back puppet. This thing could make expressions. It was, I was just blown away by it. And I was tasked with making the wings. So I had this mold and I would stipple a layer of rubber and I would put these little veins in and I made these beautiful translucent wings. They put them on the puppet. I'm like, this is awesome. This thing, you can make a whole movie about this. Film comes out. It's in one of the opening scenes. The bats come in. The puppet lands on the girl's shoulder. She looks at it, goes, and then it flies away. And that's it. You didn't even see the wings. And I'm like, when's it coming back? Like, there's got to be more. Like, we spent months building this thing for literally 3 seconds of film. You've got to
believe it.
That's a lot of times what happens. And you have to remember, you're doing something to tell the story. It's not the end all be all. And I think a fatal mistake a lot of effects guys do when they become directors is they get so focused on the thing. That's just one of the colors on the painting. Like, the painting is the thing. And, you know, going back earlier about, you know, talking about work and stuff, I remember a guy I worked with on True Blood said this. He said, look, remember, and anytime you're doing something creative or something you love, is that, you know, Todd Masters is not our boss. Alan Ball, the showrunner of True Blood, is not our boss. The work is our boss. And he's right. And that's what the focus is. And I think that's why I still get excited about working on stuff, because I still love the work. I still love the process. I still love making stuff. And I've never forgotten that. And then that's a message to people, like, the work should be the boss.
That is a great way of describing it. The work should be the boss. I think that's a beautiful way of describing that. And especially, you know, being in a creative field myself, I'm not creating monsters like you are, but I'm helping to craft stories. And also being a musician, director, producer in my own right, let the work do it. Because it's funny you say that, because I was just shooting a series of commercials recently, and a couple of the people were asking me, it was like, so what exactly is this going to look like at the very end? It's like, I can give you a general idea, but I can't tell you exactly what it's going to look like. We got to let the work make itself happen. Mm-hmm. We'll do all the takes. We'll do all the shots. We'll do all the angles.
Coverage. Yep.
But I don't know what we're going to use at the very end. It's a matter of what, you know, the magic that happens in the moment. And then you kind of look at it all. It's like, oh, I wasn't expecting that take to be awesome, but that take is awesome. And like, what you had in your mind gets totally thrown out. And then it just kind of becomes its own thing. I was talking to one of the actors. I was showing it to him later. And he was like, oh my God. It's like, I can't believe you caught that. I can't believe like you captured that. This is amazing. And again, it's just a commercial. It's nothing crazy, but it's still something. It's still the art, and it's still a lot of fun. And it was great to capture that. So this leads to
That reminded me, because I always thought as a kid, like, oh, you make a movie and it's exactly how they have it in their head. And no, a quote I heard early on is, when you go into the editing phase, that's when you find your movie. And I think it was Coppola that said, if you can get even 25% of what your head is up on the screen, you've hit a home run. And like, and again, which is, you know, it's so funny, the industry, I'm such a contradiction, because I like control. I don't like surprises. Anytime I go to set with a creature and animatronic, we've done tests, we've shot footage, we know what this thing can do. And then we get to set, it is like, it's off to the races. This could work. But I also love that spontaneity as much as I like being prepared.
Yeah.
And I think it's because generally I'm very prepared, that when something does pop up, it's like, it doesn't freak me out. I can pivot and I'm ready to go with it. I love that aspect of the business too.
Oh, absolutely. So, yeah,
I love that organic. And that's one of the things too with, I love CGI. I think CGI is a phenomenal tool. In the same breath though, what kind of movie would Jaws have been? We all know the story that Steven Spielberg shot a shark movie and the mechanical shark didn't work. So he had to figure out a way to tell his story. But what if he had CGI? What if he had that tool? When the shark broke down, like, we'll just do a CGI shark. I was like, oh, it would have sucked. I'm like, we don't know that. It would be a different film.
Very different.
But sometimes I think that the limitations force creativity, especially in storytelling, and it can create, like you said, happy accidents, like the shots of the shark, the music, the way the dock came off, and all that stuff was, again, happy accidents. I'm sure Spielberg was miserable at the time. He said Jaws was a fun movie to watch. It was not a fun movie to make.
I'm sure. No, like, stuff is going on, so. To your point, like in the case of Jaws, the fact that we saw so little of the shark made it even scarier. And that's what makes 100%. That's what makes the movie. Yes, if you had a CGI shark and you could see the shark more often, totally different film. Totally different film. It's hard to say otherwise. So yeah, along the lines of what you're saying, of like, let the work be the boss. You mentioned CGI already, and CGI, that's a great tool that, you know, it's being used and it's very important in the film, TV, and just media genre overall. That's a small part of the question I want to ask next. In a world where we're seeing a lot of technology kind of overtake some jobs, aka AI, the way things are going, we don't need to get into a huge discussion of AI, but what I want to talk about between AI, but then also censorship that we're seeing either from studios or from politics or anything like that. Why is it so important to have this real sense of expression?
Good question. I mean, I can touch briefly on my thoughts about AI, because it is a looming question. And my opinion is it's already part of the workflow to some degree.
Oh yeah.
The genie's out of the bottle. You better, it's not going back in. So you better find a way to play nice. How it's ultimately going to play out is unknown. The way my brain works, it works in corollaries and analogs. Like I have to think back. So like for years, for centuries, the only way that actors told stories was through play and through theater. When film came out, I'm sure it was very much like, well, that's the end of theater. It wasn't. When TV came out, well, that's going to be the end of film. It wasn't. So, but it did evolve. And with AI, what I think is going to happen, I'm always reminded a line from The Incredibles. If you've ever seen The Incredibles, the bad guy wants to give everybody superpowers.
Yeah.
And his line is, when everyone's super, no one will be. So I think a lot of the sense of wonder will be gone. Like in 1933, you saw King Kong come through. You'd never seen anything like that. You saw the parting of the Red Sea and the Ten Commandments. You saw Star Wars. You saw Jurassic Park. You saw The Matrix. You saw things that had never been seen before. Now you see everything. Like there's nothing that can't be done. So I think that what's going to happen is it's all going to pivot down to really good storytelling and really crafting, which is what the art was meant for. George Lucas said special effects without a story is a pretty boring thing. And I agree. You have to care about the character. You have to care about the story. That's not going anywhere. As far as censorship goes, I am not a fan of censorship because, and it becomes a slippery slope. There's a famous quote, I think it was attributed to Voltaire, that said, I may not agree with what you have to say, but I will fight to the death for your right to say it.
Yes, I'm familiar with that one.
And, you know, there's certain comedians I don't like. I don't like their subject matter. I don't like their delivery, but that's fine. I don't watch them. But I think that humans you know, or you know, Americans too are mavericks. They're rebellious, and I think a lot of that expression is a form of rebellion, which I think, you know, you can't. The more you try to squash it, you're going to have the reverse reaction of what you were hoping for, because it's going to, people are very clever. It's going to figure out a way to show itself whether you want it to or not.
I 100% agree with that. You know, it's kind of, you know, we keep bringing up Star Wars. One of the things that they always said when it came to the way that the Force worked and where Anakin came into play was to bring things into balance. And Anakin was the reaction to the dark side looming. It was the back and forth on that. So I know I'm being a nerd right here using Star Wars as an analogy, but yeah, it's true. You know, whatever you try to do, it's kind of like, it's kind of like in the story of Oedipus, minus the whole mother thing. It's the whole, like, you fear something so much, or you work to prevent something.
And you just play right into its hands.
You play right into it. Exactly.
A tragic story. Yeah, no, that was someone who tried everything he could to deny his destiny and unknowingly
caused it. Caused it, yeah. Exactly. So, no, it's very interesting that it's very interesting where we are in media. You know, as a journalist, as a creative, I look at some of the things that are happening and I'm concerned to a degree, but I'm also hopeful and excited in other degrees. It's a double-edged sword. It's two sides of a coin. So I think that's very interesting. So as we're getting towards the end of this episode, and honestly, I could be speaking to you forever here, Mark, I appreciate
it. We'll have to do another one.
But with that all being said, as a kid that was from the Northeast who made his way over to bright, shiny Hollywood, you were able to create something for yourself. You were able to create this legacy. Mm-hmm. For anybody who's still over here on the East Coast or wherever they are, who are looking to pursue that dream, but they just don't know which direction they're going to be, but they stand up in their theater and say, hey, yep, I'm going to do that, but they don't know how they're going to do that. What do you say to them right now?
I've got to quote Calvin Coolidge, because he's going to say it better than I could. And the quote is, nothing in the world will take the place of persistence. Talent will not. There are many unsuccessful men with talent. Genius will not. Unrewarded genius is almost a proverb. Education will not. There are many educated derelicts. Persistence and determination are alone omnipotent. That quote, I read it in a Tony Robbins book, and it really resonated to me, because I was not the best sculptor. I was not the best painter. I was not the best sketch artist. I was not the best makeup artist, but I would outwork anybody in anything I did. I think part of what was frustrating for me at the time is I wasn't naturally gifted, but I had a work ethic that I would literally outwork anybody. Give me the hardest work you got and I'm going to outwork them. I won't sleep. And that is something that I think is true no matter what. I'd rather have someone that's going to work hard than a talented person who just loafs off. You know, I'd rather have someone that really tries and really cares. And, you know, don't be open to, I mean, again, if you're, you know, there was a guy, I forgot his name. He plays basketball for the Harlem Globetrotters. He's like 4'11". I think his name is Short Shot or something. He wanted to play in the NBA. That ain't going to happen. I'm sure people told Muggsy Bogues and Spud Webb, you ain't going to the NBA. They did. He couldn't go to the NBA. He just couldn't do it, but he was able to play for the Harlem Globetrotters. So again, you may have your idea of what your bullseye is. Don't be, you know, be celebrated that even if you hit the target, even if it's not the bullseye, like, again, I wanted to be a sculptor. And then I went out there and I saw the sculptors and I'm like, oh God, like there's, oh God, like I would have to stop everything and just sculpt it, but I had to eat. So I would, you know, be doing other stuff. So again, and now I'm in the position where I'm very fortunate where I work with these phenomenal sculptors and we collaborate and we talk about things and I can help art direct. So again, my career took kind of a turn from where I thought I was going to go to where it wound up actually being, which was actually the best fit for me anyways than what I originally had in mind. So be open to that. And again, to be honest, I worked on Jurassic Park 3. I was called in to work on Jurassic Park, The Lost World. And I took an interview and I'm like, this is it. I'm going to achieve the goal. But they wanted me to start and I was still working on Alien Resurrection. And I'm like, I cannot quit in the middle of the show. That's like the unpardonable sin back in the day. Like, you didn't do that. And I said, I'm sorry. I have to fulfill this commitment. I'm so sorry. You guys want me to do it for you. And I remember walking out of the interview just going, damn it. I didn't achieve the goal, but I said, you know what? I was asked, I could have, but I chose to maintain my integrity. And then a few years later, it worked out even better than if I had taken that job on Lost World. 100%.
Incredible. Absolutely incredible. You never know where something's going to take you. You don't know what one decision is going to lead into, good or bad. And to kind of take it back to something that you said earlier, how we were talking about, you know, we don't know what the movie's going to look like until you get into the editing phase. look at your life as the editing phase.
100%. Give yourself, very well put, Connor.
Yeah. Give yourself the patience. Give yourself the patience to be creative, to pivot, to improvise. Treat your life like the editing phase. And I think that's, you're going to do really well in life, I think.
Absolutely. And just keep going. Just keep going. And you know, you have to, it's very hard to be objective. It's just work hard. You know, it's not just about working hard. An analogy I always said, we've all seen a fly like go against a window. He's working hard, but he ain't going to go out there until he can step back and be like, huh, I should go there and do that. So that's another aspect. It's not just blindly working hard. I mean, you can work really, I mean, you're on a treadmill, or a hamster wheel. You have to be able to step back and assess what's working, what's not, and then knowing how to course correct when necessary.
Without a doubt. Absolutely. I hear you with that. I think that's a great way to end this episode. Again, Mark, thank you so much for being here. Greatly appreciate you. And of course, we'll have information about Mark in the links in the description so you can learn more about his filmography, other projects, and just keeping up with everything that he's doing. Mark, again, thank you so much.
Thank you, Connor. My honor. Thank you.
Awesome, Mark. Seriously, I really appreciate this. This is
a
great opportunity. Again, from the 10-year-old me to the 28-year-old me, thank you for giving your time to me. And
was it 10 years old when I sent you that stuff?
It was around that time. It was around that time because it would have had to have been after the second Pirates of the Caribbean. Because
it was 06, 07, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, because I would have had the molds by then for that stuff.
Yep, and I was in 2007 turning 10. So it would have had to have been around that time because obviously, Will Turner's Coin, that would have been around by then, but you needed to have been working on the second film to have sent me the key. So, for me to understand what the key was.
Davy Jones's locker, right? Yeah.
So I was about 10, 11, maybe 11.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Crazy.
I know. It's kind of, but again, just kind of like what we said before, you never know how like one instance is going to affect something later on. Like here we are all these years later. As professionals in our own fields, getting to talk about this.
Right. I mean, you're not a kid. You're like an equal. Like, you're a dude. Like, it's like, I'm still tripping out. You know what I mean? So I'm going to call my uncle tomorrow and say, you're not going to believe what I just did a podcast with. So,
Amazing. Amazing. Well, awesome. Mark, I will let you have the rest of your evening. It is 9:12 here on the East Coast, and I haven't been home all day. So I'm going to head home now.
Time to tap out. Good night, Connor. Thank you again.
Good night. Appreciate you, Mark.
See you. I appreciate you. Thank you. Let's do it again.
Yes, totally.
And that's a wrap on this week's episode. Much love to our sponsors this week, MHA of Dutchess County, Foman Wash Car Wash, Juniors 2, Council on Addiction Prevention and Education of Dutchess County Incorporated, Dayrock, Lockset Rock Hair Design, A Touch of Naples Pizza and Pasta, Dutchess Beer Distributors, Feldman Kleiman Collins and Sape LLP, Attorneys at Law, and Walsh Valuation. Thank you to our Walsh Wednesday All-Stars, all of those who have generously contributed to the Walsh Wednesday 2025 Fund Drive. You can see the list of names on screen or in the description of this episode. And of course, thank you to our Walsh Wednesday Warriors, Jim Robinson, John Newhall, Meg Boyce, and Jenna Hess. These individuals have pledged $100 or more to Walsh Wednesday for 2025, either through the GoFundMe or our Patreon.